How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dragon King Dark audio show. I'm your host, Carl Stern. Thanks a lot for listening to the show. We are back here today to go into the mailbag. I've actually got several emails that we're going to take a look at and get kind of caught up. We're going to use this as sort of a catch-up show, more so than any one real topic. The prior shows you've heard, I taped several of those ahead. So if you send in an email, don't worry that we haven't gotten to it yet. Some of those shows were already pre-taped. But now that we're kind of caught up to real time, if you send in an email to Carl at DragonKingCarl.com, that's Carl with letter K, K-A-R-L, at DragonKingCarl.com, the odds are I'm going to be a little quicker getting to it now. And that's what I want to spend today doing, is answering a few emails about some of the recent shows. This is the fifth regular edition. I'm calling this episode 5, even though we had a zero episode, which was kind of an introduction as far as our themed episodes go. We're up now to episode 5. If you haven't listened to our prior shows, let me encourage you to do so, because it's kind of necessary, really, with some of these emails. If you hear us talk about something referenced in one of the earlier shows, maybe it'll spark your interest to go back and listen. Again, this show will cover a broad variety of topics, and I understand not every single one may be your area of interest. But we will hit something that will be, I'm almost certain, because we're going to be so eclectic about what we talk about on this show. The first episode was about the psychology of fear. The second show, which we will have a follow-up on today, was about a local legend named Aunt Jenny Johnson. Highly recommend going and listening to that show. The third one was on Monster Comics, horror-themed horror-themed characters in popular comic books, and it's a theme we're going to revisit in the future as well. And then our last show, which I was joined by my wife Tanya on the show, talked about one of the most haunted places in America that we've actually been to a couple times, Sloss Furnace. And if you haven't listened to that show, again, I encourage you to do so as well. So let's start off today. I believe I will start off, first of all, with a follow-up on Aunt Jenny Johnson, or Jenny Brooks Johnson, which, again, we talked about on episode 2 of our show. And I was turned on to the fact that there's actually a blog. Now, this blog post is a few years old. Actually, it's quite a few years old now. But again, it retells parts of the story with a few details we didn't touch on. And you can access this blog at auntjennyjohnson.blogspot.com. And this actually is from a 2009 post, but I thought since I was sent this link, it would be well worth looking into. And again, if you missed that show, this is a place local to me. I've been there many, many, many times. I've saw all this stuff, and so we'll go through it. This is, again, Aunt Jenny Johnson. When the war between the states came to her door in late 1863, Louisa Elizabeth Jane Bates Brooks, that is why it's easily shortened to Aunt Jenny Johnson, I would say, was 37 years old. A beautiful blue-eyed half-Cherokee from Walker County, Alabama. She had married Willis Brooks, a saddler and bootmaker from Kentucky, when she was 14 and he was 35. Yes, times have certainly changed. Willis called her Jenny. Together, they raised a large family, 8 kids, and ran a roadhouse, sort of a combination tavern and inn on the Byler Road in southwest Lawrence County. The mountain folk of Alabama had never been keen on secession. This is, of course, true, as we talked about on that show. They looked at it as a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. We're speaking of the American Civil War here. And most tried, at first, to just stay out of the way and remain neutral. But the Confederacy enacted a draft law and a tax in kind law. The first made it mandatory for young white Southerners to serve in the Confederate Army, and the second demanded that any poor folks who could not afford to pay their taxes in hard cash had to give up part of their crops or their farm animals to support the war. To enforce these laws, the Confederate Home Guard was mobilized to seek out draft dodgers, whom they called outliers or mossbacks, and to seize the war levy from the poor farmers who lived in the hills. The farmers viewed this as theft of their food from their children's mouths. They hardly had enough to eat in the best of times to get through the winter, and now the Confederacy wanted them to starve their children to feed Jefferson Davis' army. These laws ensured that the war would come to the mountains of Alabama. Now, John Brooks was about 17 when the Home Guard rode up the Byler Road Inn. The Home Guard was made up of men who were too old, too young, or had medical conditions that prevented them from joining the Army. There were also men who were exempted by virtue of the fact that they had 20 or more slaves. This loophole was for rich planters and was deeply resented by the poor white farmers who made up the bulk of the Confederate Army and led to many desertions. The hills around the Brooks Tavern were in fact full of deserters and draft dodgers by late 1863. I still live in those hills, not very far away at all from where this was, probably, 5 miles by woods, maybe at most 6 or 7 miles by woods from we're talking about this story. Even more men had run off to join the 1st Alabama Union Cavalry Regiment or to become scouts and spies for the Union Army. And this is, in fact, true. There was an Alabama Union Cavalry Regiment which fought not for the Confederacy but for the Union. And I actually had a grandparent, a great-great-grandparent, that fought for the Confederacy and one that fought for the Union. He was a member of this 1st Alabama Union Cavalry Regiment, one on my mother's side, one on my father's side, each on separate sides of the American Civil War. So many stories have grown up around the legend of Aunt Jeannie that we don't know for sure what the Home Guard patrol of 8 men had in mind when they stopped at the Brooks place. Even the date is a bit hazy. It was probably late 1863, but could have been early 1864. They might have been looking to draft young John Brooks, or they might have wanted to punish Willis Brooks for aiding Union men and Confederate deserters who were hiding all throughout the hills of North Alabama. What is certain is that at gunpoint, 57-year-old Willis Brooks was seized, bound, and tortured. The Home Guard put a noose around Willis' neck and started to hang him from the limb of a tree in his own front yard. Jeannie and the children, including Angeline, 15, Mac, 13, Amanda, 11, Willis Jr., 9, Donner, a 7-year-old girl, and Ganem, 3, could only watch in horror lest they too be killed. Her youngest son, Henry, was an infant, still nursing. When John burst from the house to save his father, he was shot dead by the Home Guard. Then they shot Willis Brooks Sr. as he hung in the tree and rode away. Now, all the versions of the legends of Aunt Jeannie Brooks that are told, this much is certain. Jeannie Brooks lowered her husband's body out of the tree, laid him next to their oldest son, and gathered all the children around, placing the boy's hands in the sticky blood on their father's chest, even Tiny Henry's. Jeannie made them swear a blood oath that they would never rest until all 8 of those killers were dead. Later, Jeannie would proudly say that she wasted many a keg of powder teaching my boys how to shoot. The feud that started with the killing of Jeannie Brooks' husband and oldest son in 1863 lasted 40 years. Jenny and her second son, Mac, got the first home guard, the leader, in early 1864 when they shot him from his horse after he left his house. Jenny made Mac help her drag the body into the woods where she cut off his head. She then put it in a burlap sack and carried it home. There she threw it in a large boiling pot used to make lye soap and scooped and scrubbed the viscera away until she had a nice clean skull minus the jawbone. This she used as a soap dish for the rest of her life. Her boys, brought up with the sole purpose in life of being their father and brother's avenging angels, become deadly expert shooters and fairly competent killers. The war, like all wars, eventually ended. The feud did not. While Jenny kept track by making notches on a hickory stick, her boys sought out and killed 7 of the 8 Confederate home guards and another 12 or 13 friends or relatives of the home guard of the Confederacy, those who got in the way trying to thwart their efforts. The 8th literally disappeared off the face of the earth when he realized he was being stalked by the Brooks and their brother-in-law, Sam Baker, who soon as well would be known as a stone-cold killer. Rumors said that he, too, was actually killed, but in her old age, by then known by the honorific title of Aunt, Jenny never claimed him, saying as she waved the hickory stick, 7 of them have been got. Of her sons and son-in-law who joined the feud, only Henry survived the bloodletting, and he himself was shot in the early 1920s by a large posse from nearby Winston County while pursuing an age-old mountain tradition of making moonshine. Heavily outnumbered, he managed to get off 6 or 7 shots before he was hit 12 times. It took Henry Brooks 15 minutes to die. The revenuers also managed to kill his horse. Aunt Jenny was always proud of her sons, saying to whomever came to visit, and many people did come to visit her during her last years, they said no one was elected on the Republican ticket in Winston County unless Aunt Jenny approved of him. They all died like men, with their boots on. She outlived them all, passing away in her bed at the age of 98 on March 29th, 1924. A shopkeeper once asked her, why did she keep so much money on her? And she replied, rather pointedly, I pay myself $20 a week just to tend to my own business. As she lay dying, surrounded by her many friends and kinfolk, her pastor asked if there was anything else they could do for her before she crossed over. Jenny then paused and then said weakly, I'd like to wash my hands. And so they brought a pan of water and Aunt Jenny's soap dish that she made back in 1864. One last time, she washed her hands in that murderer's skull, and when her hands were dry, she closed her eyes and died. So, again, some more details added to this really fantastic, but, almost certainly parts of it true story of the local legend of Aunt Jenny Johnson. This article, again, if you want to read it yourself, is at auntjennyjohnson.blogspot.com, and this particular post was from back in 2009. It also goes on to say, as legend has it, if you go to the cemetery next to her house at night and sit there with no lights on, you can see a green glowing light coming closer to you. If you listen real close, you can hear her and her kids screaming at you to get out or you'll be next. Of course, done this a million times and never happened, but nevertheless, very, very interesting story of local lore and legend. Our next email comes from Eric, and Eric wants to comment on the fact that we'll be talking about some philosophy here on this website as well. One of my favorite topics to study. I read lots of books on philosophy, listen to lots of podcasts, watch documentaries on it. It's one of my more favorite, I guess, hobby studies to do. And Eric says, I'd love you to do a show on relativism and postmodernism. I had a senior class on relativism and hated the topic. Quote, truth is in the eye of each individual and there is no universal truth. I didn't like that. I guess I walked into class with a bias, being a Christian, and walked out with an appreciation on seeing how our culture is heading. and says, which falls heavily down on relativism. And yes, actually, I would like to do certainly a show on that. I should read and brush up on those particular topics to start with as well. I think the truth lies somewhere just outside those bounds, but certainly we'll talk a lot more about it and get some thoughts from much greater philosophers than myself on that matter. Certainly a great, fantastic topic suggestion, and I really appreciate it. It's one of the things that very soon we're going to delve more into. The mind of man is certainly a incredible topic. I'm reading a book right now from the late, great writer Napoleon Hill, and he is very much of the positive mindset sort of thing. He is very much that we in many ways. Now, he is certainly a Christian in his writings. He is leans very heavily toward his religious beliefs, but he also is of the school of thought that, you know, he's kind of that very early. So some of the things he said were very key in what later became known as like the Secret, which was very popular for a period of time about, you know, several years ago. That sort of that positive energy attracts positive energies and stuff, and gets into kind of that beyond philosophy, more into metaphysics and whatever. But certainly that's one of the things we definitely want to get into. So thanks a lot, Eric, for that suggestion. Stick around. I'm sure you'll be pleased with it coming up on some future shows. Now, here's a wonderful email that comes from James. And James says, I want to compliment you on your first Dragon King Dark podcast. Your closing comments were very important, and I hope as many people as possible get to hear them, and better yet, heed them. And what James is referring to is actually the Zero episode, where I talk about looking outward and inward, and I talk about how mankind has become too self-obsessed with the little things that go on here on the planet, drawing out territories, fighting over religious and philosophical ideas, instead of conquering this vast universe, which, so far as we know, belongs to us. Now, again, you'll hear my thoughts on how that's probably not true, but as far as we know, being the key word there, we are the only intelligent life we know of in the greater universe, yet we're sitting here turning in on ourselves and accomplishing little to nothing with the fact that here we are with almost, if not in fact, an infinite universe here. And the infinity of the universe is another topic we're going to certainly be covering coming up. But James goes on in reflection on those comments. I feel too many people do not appreciate the remarkable events which resulted in such a varied array of life on this planet, or the factors that went into producing intelligent technological civilizations. It does not really matter if one believes in randomness or intelligent design. The fact remains that so many things had to come into play for us to be here. The speed of our planet's rotation, the axial tilt, the distance from the sun, the size of our moon and its tidal effects are just a few of the things that made life here possible. Perhaps such conditions might be reproduced elsewhere, and I do believe it's possible. But for all practical purposes, we really are here alone. Our intelligent and technological life might exist, but it would probably be so remote and so distant, the distance is so vast, that it would be extremely difficult to find or establish contact with it. I stress intelligent and technological life is important. Here on Earth, dolphins and whales are intelligent, but they have no technology, and meaningful communication with them is difficult. Microbes on Mars would be interesting, but ultimately would not really mean a lot to us in the overall scheme of things. We are fortunate to have a planet with temperate conditions that allowed us to be outside at night, and clear skies that allowed us to see stars and spark our imaginations as to what lies beyond. I doubt such a thing could happen on a cloud-shrouded planet like Venus, or being on the surface, or what would pass as the surface, I suppose, of Jupiter. In a way, we live in a three bears type of world where we are the baby bear. Our world is neither too much of one thing or too much of another, but just right. It was the just right conditions that allowed the baby bear to make discoveries, just as we are still in our infancy making discoveries every day. One final thing, you mentioned the million monkey theory, so I thought I would attach a humorous short story I wrote once on the subject. Maybe you'll get a kick out of it. And so thank you very much for including that. And I want to perhaps follow up on that in the future, because I've got more stuff to say about that as well, and we'll cover that. But James, thanks a lot. It's a very, I love these types of very thoughtful, thought-provoking emails and stuff. You mentioned, I want to go back to one of the thoughts you mentioned here was on dolphins and whales are intelligent but have no technology. And that got me to thinking about, you know, just information in general. And by information, I mean, you know, here's an example. If I take my dog, my pet dog, and I set him in front of a typewriter, and I take and put his paws on a keyboard, and he moves around a little bit, and I pull out a piece of paper, and the paper is just a jumble of various characters and stuff on this page, random spaces, numbers intermixed with special symbols and letters and capitalizations, or maybe the caps lock key is locked. My dog has put information on a paper, but it's relatively useless. And so when you look at that, you think, well, you know, it's just a dog. He's unintelligent. He's just, you know, it's very random, and there's no real useful information about that. And you would be largely right. However, if I showed you a piece of paper that I told you my dog typed, and the paper said, you know, AAAA space 1111 space 5555. You might for a moment stop and think, well, that's a little better than random. There does seem to be some pattern there. Not really sure what you do with that information. It's not really useful. How could the dog have accidentally, come up with a pattern that of information? And yes, he probably could have. There's probably not too much to read into that. It's one of those things. Now, could the dog replicate that exact same sequence again? Probably not. But let's say he did it twice. He did exactly that same thing in two different settings. I carried him to the local university and said, hey, this is my dog typed this, and I want you to, under sterile conditions, reproduce, see if he can reproduce this. And let's say he did. Let's say he reproduced exactly that same sequence. Well, you might then say, wow, you've got a really smart dog. There's something he's trying to communicate. Well, I don't know what. It's really, when you get down to the end of it, he really didn't communicate anything. But that's a smart dog. But what if I told you my dog, I put him in front of a typewriter and he typed out, my name is Spot? Well, then you would, of course, be naturally skeptical, but you would say, well, okay, look, that didn't happen by random accident. You know, there was clearly, it would be virtually statistically impossible for your dog to type accidentally, my name is Spot, especially if the dog's name is Spot. And can you reproduce this? So we go to the same thing. We go to a university somewhere and set up an experiment, and the dog repeats it. And he repeats it multiple times on keyboards of typewriters, of word processing computers. He does this every single time you put him down. He deliberately types out, "My name is Spot." Well, you've got something beyond a smart dog here. You've got an incredibly smart dog, and he's actually communicating to you useful information. It's not just random. It's not like the sequence of characters we talked about before, but it's actually meaningful information. And so now we've moved up the intellect chain. We're up into something else. Now, what can you do with that information? It's still, not a lot you can do with that information, but man, you've really got, can you teach this dog more stuff? Is this the only thought he has? How did he learn the English language? I mean, there's lots of things to be studied and learned about that, and all from just the slight amount of change there. But let's say that you sit the dog down, and the dog this time types, "My name is Spot. I want to eat, Steve." And you've now got something more. You've now got not only deliberately telling you information, but he's requesting something. He's communicating. This is actual communication. If you change just a few characters in there, it becomes, garbled nonsense. But this is specific information that he is stating something and asking for something in return. He's punctuated it exactly right. He's filled in, he's put commas there because, hey, just that one comma, "I want to eat, comma, Steve." Well, you leave that out and suddenly he doesn't want Steve to feed the dog. He wants to eat Steve. There's a big difference there. So that's an even much, much greater level of intellect there. So what does that analogy mean? What does it say? Well, it says out there to me in the vastness of the greatness of the universe that just like James said, perhaps we discover microbes on Mars. In fact, I think it's very possible. And certainly in my lifetime, if there are microbes to be found there, I think we will find them. I think it's very likely that there was some sort of microbial life that existed at one point in the past on Mars. And even not beyond the realm of possibility that still could possibly exist there. It just remains to be seen. Perhaps in my lifetime, a little less likely, but perhaps in my lifetime, we may, in fact, be able to send probes or rovers or something like that to some of the moons of Saturn or the moons of Jupiter, where there's an even more likely possibility that there is presently existing life there. But again, what will it communicate to us? Will it? Can it? Or is it just random garbled information on a piece of paper? Or is it something more? And so James, while I am a firm believer that out there in the vastness of the universe and in the infinity of space, and you hear me say that sometimes, and I know the first thing people want to say is space isn't infinite. I still firmly believe that there is a strong likelihood that space is in fact infinite, that we will break outside of those confines. Now, perhaps our universe itself is finite, but I believe it's part of an infinite continuation of other universes in a multiverse that continues to exist one layer on top of the other. While our layer may be finite, the entirety of it is not. That's, again, personal philosophy, personal belief on my part. So I don't want to get you confused there by thinking, well, our host knows nothing because he thinks space is infinite. It's a little more complicated than that. So somewhere out there in the vastness of this multiverse, I firmly believe there's intelligent communicable beings out there. Maybe they don't look like us. Maybe they do. Maybe they're similar. Maybe they're vastly different. But sometime in our lifetime, I think we're going to find somewhere on that scale between random characters being, random information being just splashed on a page that's really meaningless to something much, much more. Now, again, in my lifetime, I don't know. I really have this feeling that in my lifetime, we are going to discover some sort of alien life. Now, it may have been, long dead and fossilized. It may be, not current living life, but I really do believe at some point in time, we're going to discover this. I don't necessarily think, a UFO is going to sit down in Central Park in New York and, a spaceman stroll out and say, take me to your leader. That seems a little unlikely, highly unlikely. But I do think we will find something out there. We will dig in the right spot on Mars and dig up just the right rock that has a fossil in it, or just the right, overturn the right stone and underneath some microbe. I think barring that happening at some point in time, we will send some sort of probe to a moon of Saturn or Jupiter where they're in the ocean underneath the shell of ice that covers it in a heated ocean, heated by the pull of the parent planet on that moon. We will find perhaps living life, some sort of aquatic life underneath these oceans, if something maybe even more substantial than microbes or bacteria. And I believe that's all relatively possible in our lifetime. If we can just, as a planet, get our head out of the sand long enough. And it doesn't just have to be the United States. There's our hopes can be out there with China and maybe India and other technologically advanced countries that are out there. If we can just stop bickering amongst ourselves long enough over differences in ideology. And again, I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody's faith or belief or whatever. You may very well be right in those things, but the forced proselytizing of those on other people has done so much harm to our planet and humanity, and held us back so many. If we hadn't have had to go through the Dark Ages, if we hadn't had to, even in these modern times, where 100 years ago, just 100 years ago, which is less than a millisecond of the time this planet's existed, less than 100 years ago, we weren't even flying, much less going to the moon, much less putting rovers on Mars. We didn't have jet planes, anything like that. And to have come this far, made this great a technological leap in the last 100 years, almost looks supernatural. In the future, in the far-flung future, when archaeologists are looking back on us, it's going to be very easy, if they're still the same mindset we are today, to subscribe some sort of supernatural occurrence to have having taken place sometime between 1850 and the year 2000. In that 150-year time period, it's almost going to look supernatural to them. And there's going to be all kinds of theories, just like we have about the building of the pyramids and the fact that so many different structures were built on different continents around the world in a similar time period through no seeming communication between these different cultures. It's going to look very, very remarkable, if not supernatural. So I'll leave you with this thought today, and thank you very much again for the fantastic email, James. I'll leave you with this thought today that, again, we're looking at the wrong things. We are continuing to worry about the wrong stuff. We continue to put resources into stuff that 500 years from now will not matter. We need to be, with these technological leaps we've had, we need to be doing more stuff that 500 years from now will matter. 500 years from now, it will very much matter that we walked on the moon. 500 years from now, it very much will matter that we've got rovers sitting on Mars. At that time, by that time, long defunct, sitting there as junk, but we've made our mark out there. People know we went. We jumped to that level of sophistication. We got to that degree of putting mankind further out there to explore this universe that, whether you believe it came here by random accident or intelligent design, appears to have been given to us, for whatever your philosophy is. So why not embrace it? Why are we still here fighting over lines in the sand when we could be out there embracing the entirety of the universe? I hope you've enjoyed this show. We'll be back next week with another show. I don't have a topic yet. Perhaps you could choose the topic like James did. Send in an email to carl@dragonkingcarl.com. That's Carl with the letter K. KARL@dragonkingcarl.com. Please, in the heading, would you put Dragon King Dark so I can differentiate it from my other podcast I do and be able to go right to it. I really appreciate these articulate, very well thought out, thought provoking emails. I'm so floored by the ones I've been getting that are so well thought out. I really appreciate that. So if you can take just a few moments to put your thoughts on information in electronic form and send it to me at carl@dragonkingcarl, we'd really appreciate it. You can check out my website at dragonkingcarl.com. I have my own website apart from afterdarkradioshow.com. I am dragonkingcarl.com. Please check it out. I have some things there available for purchase if you're interested. If not, you can just read the blog postings or whatever, but I really would appreciate your support. And really important to me is if you follow me on Twitter, you can correspond with me there. I am at dragonkingcarl, all one word, dragonkingcarl, and as always, it's Carl with the letter K. Thanks a lot for listening. Thanks a lot to Brian and the AfterDarkRadioShow.com network. And we'll be back next week with another show.
How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
Getting you?
Oh, no. I'm just thinking about public reaction to all this.